good morning. After spreading of our attention, we're now coming back to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 2. When Jesus returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. So many gathered around, there was no longer room for them, not even in front of the door, and he was speaking the word. Speaking the word, God's word. And we've already had a hint in 1:14, this is the good news about God, and it's the good news from God to us. Then some people came bringing to him a paralyzed man, carried by four of them. And when they couldn't bring him to Jesus because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. Various bits of greenery, branches, and then clay, of course. So it's not too difficult to remove it and dig a hole in it. After having dug through the roof, they let down the mat on which the paralyzed man lay. When Jesus saw their faith, their openness to grace, their deep desire for healing, all of that, he said to the paralyzed man, sounds a bit awkward in English and I couldn't think of a better way of putting it, son, the Greek is technon, which was a familiar, friendly way of even adults speaking to each other. So son doesn't quite get it. If you're a communist, you could say comrade. I'm not sure of any better way. It's not quite friend, but it is a friendly way of speaking, even to an adult. Your sins are forgiven. So Jesus is perceiving something here. The paralysis that Mark is talking about in this scene, on which he's focusing, and I'll come back to this, is the paralysis of sin. That it's not so much a bodily paralysis that is his interest, it's the deeper paralysis that sin can bring into our lives, unable to move. Now, some of the scribes were sitting there, questioning in their hearts, why does this fellow speak in this way? It's blasphemy. In our culture, that doesn't go as deep as it does here, except perhaps in some of these Islamic cultures under Sharia law, which you're quite familiar with. And blasphemy is death is the punishment for blasphemy. It was also in the Old Testament. So to be thinking of Jesus as blaspheming, we're starting to get the beginnings of this fraught situation in which Jesus is in his ministry. Who can forgive sin, they said, but God alone? Psalm 85 doesn't quite say that, but in a prayer to God, it says, you forgive the iniquity of your people. You pardoned all their sin. Of course, God is the forgiver. But are we separating God away from us? Is there God and you so that God can forgive and you can't? Well, that's not the Christian view, of course, and it isn't the view of Mark here. Here's a statement from Leviticus chapter 20. Do not turn to mediums or wizards. Do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. A man or a woman who is a medium or a wizard doing magical things that are outside the Torah must be stoned to death. Their blood is upon them. So the scribes who are coming from that viewpoint are looking at Jesus as a blasphemer. You could have said wizard. Another statement from Leviticus. Every man who preaches apostasy under the dominion of the spirits of Belial, another name for Beelzebul, we'll get that in a moment, shall be judged according to the law relating to those possessed by a ghost or a familiar spirit. So Jesus is in dangerous ground here. At once, immediately, Jesus perceived in his spirit that they were discussing these questions among themselves. And he said to them, why do you raise such questions in your hearts? Which is easier, to say to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven, which is what he's just done, or to say, stand up, take up your mat and walk? But so that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins, he turned to the paralyzed man and said, I say to you, stand up, take up your mat, and go to your home. And he stood up and immediately took the mat and went out before all of them, so that they were amazed and glorified God, saying, we've never seen anything like this. So Mark and the early church that accepted Mark as a valid, in fact quite beautiful, portrait of Jesus is inviting us to look at the scene, read it, see what responses come up in your heart as you read it. Then we're invited, aren't we, to be the paralyzed man and go back into the scene. Now we're in the scene now, and we're on a stretcher. Thank God we have some friends who love us enough to take us to Jesus, but we're paralyzed. Paralyzed by early family training in which we've acquired dysfunctional habits, perhaps, that we don't seem to be able to break. We can't move. Faced with a vocational crisis and we don't know which way to go. We're paralyzed. So we do that and see what emerges in our psyche as we listen. And then thirdly, of course, we are encouraged to be Jesus in that scene. Because Jesus obviously said, love one another as I've loved you. You do what I do. You'll do greater things yet, he even says. So you be Jesus now. And you think of the paralyzed people, perhaps, in your life, that come to you because of you're a nurse, or you're a pastoral associate, or you're a mother, or you're a friend, or you're a public, oh, good heavens, why? You're a policeman, a whole lot of, but some people are coming to you and they're clearly paralyzed. Can we do nothing? Or are we asked to attend to their paralysis? And if it's the paralysis of sin, are we being asked to forgive? Jesus says, look, of course God's the only one who can forgive, but God's in everybody. So as we say in the Our Father, we're so used to it, forgive us our sins the way we forgive those who sin against us. So if I hurt you and you don't forgive me, well, I can find forgiveness from God, you know that, but it's always incomplete unless you forgive me. Go on, you're the one I hurt. So Jesus is telling us, forgive one another. Son of man, human being, can forgive. Of course, and I don't want to go into this and you don't want me to either, in the early church, quite quickly, it emerged that sometimes the sin people forgive, and the three big ones were apostasy, adultery, and murder, might be so public and cut right across the community that the synod can't go around to every member of the community and get forgiveness. It just doesn't work like that. So the community decided that the organisational leader of the community, it was up to him to be the one. And so I, the one who'd sinned publicly and broken from the community by my behaviour, I could go to him. And if he was satisfied that I was truly repentant, he would give me absolution, forgiveness. And you'd all know that he'd done it. So, confident in that, you'd welcome me back into the community. Please God, or at least you should. So there's a place for the sacrament of reconciliation, of course. The problem, of course, is that I was brought up, you were brought up, I was told by a teacher here in this little room that's now the chapel that I was a scatterbrained boy. So I thought I better take this seriously. So I stopped being scatterbrained for a day. And I was rescued by my friends who came up to me and said, Mick, we preferred you the way you were. In other words, trying to be serious and all this. And then I got the insight. I thought, well, all I've got is a scattered brain, I better use it. Like, you've got to be who you are. So I didn't take much more notice of that priest after that. Why did I tell you that? I was going, oh, yes. Well, because I was a scattered brain, it didn't hurt me as much as it did other people. We grew up with mortal sins all over the place. It's just a dime a dozen. It's a hopeless situation. Brought up. Hopeless in our vision of God and of ourselves and of psychic development and everything. When I was in the seminary, I think we learnt that, I don't know how many, some of you will know, but there's no need to be exact about it, but I think saying Mass, a priest can commit 20 or something mortal sins. You know, if you don't have this then, don't have that 100, and it's not on top of it. And I won't take you through all that. I remember thinking, sounds bizarre to me, so my scatterbrain saved me. But there are far more earnest people around who took it seriously. I remember watching one priest, a lot older than me then, not now, but then, and I can remember my heart was bleeding for him, but I didn't know what to do. I was too young, I'm 18 or 19 or something, and I'm in a seminary, and he used to say Mass for us sometimes. And truly it was dreadful because he'd be there and then he'd be lifting the corporal to make sure the chalice was on top of the altar stone and then saying the words of consecration. Getting them out was such a... Someone with more brains than me should have done something about it. Maybe they tried. Guess what? Finish that off. The sacrament of reconciliation was pretty hopeless. In earlier times, it's opened itself up now, please God, because mortal sins were too common. Well, they weren't sins, mortals. They didn't cut us off from God and they didn't cut us off from the community. They weren't mortal, they didn't kill the soul. But there were a pile of them around, as you probably know. Back to the gospel. We're watching a scene reminding us that our sin, which paralyzes us, and may well be mortal, can be, the the sin that's paralyzing me can be forgiven. And the sin that's paralyzing you, I can forgive if I'm part of it, and you can too. The next scene. Jesus went out again beside the sea. The whole crowd gathered around him and he taught them. Here's the Mark's Gospel. Jesus, the teacher. It doesn't actually give us the teaching, but we're watching what he does to learn what he taught. He taught them. And as he was walking along, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed Jesus. There's so much under that scene that's quite extraordinary. There's Caravaggio's painting of this, quite brilliant really. There's Jesus, that's Peter there, Jesus pointing to Levi, Matthew, and saying, "You come and follow me." Levi has been robbing the fishermen for years. And Matthew, Peter, Andrew, and James and John are all fishermen. So to be invited to follow Jesus is to be invited to join these fellas. Who, what the heck are you doing inviting him in? Because his job as a tax collector, he was collecting the tax for Herod. And Herod would demand a lot, so he had to cheat to get enough for himself over and above what he should have been getting. So there's all that going on. And here's Jesus sweeping all that aside and reaching through to Matthew and saying, "You follow me." And as he sat at dinner in Levi's house, wait a minute, here's Jesus going into the house of a sinner, of someone who wouldn't be allowed in the synagogue, certainly not in the temple or any gathering of Jewish people, because he's working for the enemy for a start, but he's also dealing with sordid stuff like money, and so he's imperfect, not allowed in. So Jesus goes to his house. Sounds simple to us, but it's a dreadful thing he's doing for the scribes and Pharisees. Many tax collectors and sinners, just a general word for those not acceptable in the community, were also sitting with Jesus and his disciples. For there were many who followed him. Many sinners were following Jesus. When the scribes of the Pharisees, the word Pharisee means the separated ones. They saw themselves as quite special. When they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Quite a fair question. Because from their point of view, a prophet, a good man would never do that. He's breaking the law. He's breaking God's will as described in their documents. So why is he doing it, they ask. When Jesus heard that they were asking this question, he said to them, "Those who are well don't need a physician. It's for those who are sick. I've come to call not the righteous, if there are any. If you think yourself righteous, that's fine. But I haven't come to call you because you're already living a good life," inverted commas. "I've come to call sinners." So what's surprising is that I'm here with them. He's trying to love them out of their sin, not condemn them in it. This whole passage is about liberation. Liberation from sin, liberation from social restrictions that society is putting on people, and now liberation from a slavish ritual of fasting. he's getting closer and closer to the ultimate liberation, which is from the Torah itself. Well, here we are. John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. So, what was the Feast of Yom Kippur? I don't know. There were a couple of days during the year when you're all expected to fast. And if some of you might belong to or lived in, we don't have it. And that's partly to our defect. But some cultures, everybody does what everybody does. And if you don't, you stand out, and there's a lot of social pressure to conform. So the disciples and the Pharisees, John's disciples, were fasting, and people came and say to him, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't? Again, a fair question if they want an answer. Or if the question is just to put him down or isolate him, that's different altogether. And look at Jesus' answer. It's quite... it must have gone over their head. I hope it didn't, but the answer doesn't seem to be an immediate answer to their question. He says, the wedding guests can't fast while the bridegroom is with them. As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they can't fast. Everyone would nod their head, of course. So what's going on? He sees life as a wedding banquet. In fact, John takes this so seriously, he begins his gospel with a wedding feast of Cana to make this point. People are good at doing the religious things, fasting, etc., etc., etc. In a way, we kind of have to do it. We don't, because we live in a culture that's lost its roots, probably, so we don't have anything to conform to. But most do, and they certainly did. So he's saying, you're good at all that, but what you're not good at is realizing that life is a wedding banquet, that you're loved, that God is the bridegroom of Israel, of you. And Jesus is the incarnation of that God, the lover. The days will come, of course, when the bridegroom is taken from them. And then, of course, they can fast. There's a place for fasting. But not now, says Jesus. This is the time for celebration and for waking up to what religion and life are all about. To reflect on that passage, I'm going to take you through an absolutely gorgeous passage from Isaiah chapter 58. The disciples in the exile, there was a group of temple singers, because there's no temple anymore, the kind of people that created the Psalms. And they're over there, they haven't got a temple, and they set their heart on the prophecies of Isaiah, not only Isaiah, but they developed this wonderful literature, which you know, it's in the Isaiah scroll, not by Isaiah, of course, chapter 40 to 56. And it's beautiful stuff. And the disciples of them have come back with great hope to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And they were full of such all the promises that they were in that Isaiah literature, we'll call it. But when they came back, the leaders of the community, and this can happen so easily to any of us, their way of being faithful to God was to tighten things rather than open them up. So, to make sure they weren't punished by God again, they made sure they did everything right, which means according to their understanding of right. So they had to get rid of their Moabite wives and their kids, and they had to do this, and they had to conform to this, and they had to conform to something else. And the disciples of the temple, of the exile group, hear they're crying out for it. Breakthrough in this institutional violence. And this is what they write. Shout out. Don't hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Day after day they seek me. That's good. And they delight to know my ways. That's good. as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and didn't forsake the ordinances of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. And they say, why do we fast? But you, God, don't see. Why humble ourselves and you don't take any notice? Look, says this group of prophets, God speaking through them, you serve your own interest on your fast day. That's the problem. You oppress your workers. You fast only to quarrel and fight. You're doing the right religious things, but look at your lives. You strike with the wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is that the kind of fast that I choose? A day to humble yourself? Is it to bow down with your head like a bulrush or lie in sackcloth and ashes? Are you going to call this a fast, a day acceptable to Yahweh? Isn't this the kind of fast that I want, says God? Loose the bonds of injustice. Undo the thongs of the yoke. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? You can imagine Jesus so moved when he read this, and it's very like the Last Judgment parable of Jesus. When you see the naked, cover them, and don't hide yourself from your own kin. Then, if that's the way you're going to live, your light will break forth like the dawn. Your healing will spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of Yahweh shall be your rear guard. Then you'll call, and Yahweh will answer. You'll cry for help, and he'll say, here I am. Here I am with the poor, the broken, the refugees treated like mud, etc., etc. That's where I am, says God. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry to satisfy their needs, then your light will rise in the darkness and your gloom be like noonday. Yahweh will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never run dry. Some of that is in the mind of Jesus as he doesn't fast because he wants to say something else. And Jesus in that context makes a couple of quite brilliant little comparisons. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth, because the cloth's going to shrink, on an old cloak. Otherwise the patch pulls away and the new from the old, and the worst tear is made. Everybody or every woman in the group knows that in here. Maybe the men do, but it's clear enough. If you've got an unshrunk cloth, you better put it in a situation where everything will shrink together. It has to belong. And another one, which everyone knew about too, you don't put new wine into old wineskins, because the new wine is going to expand. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is lost, and so are the skins. New wine, new wineskins. I can't read that without a good deal of sadness, really, when I think of the beautiful Vatican Council and the new wine skins that happened. We turned the altar around, we made everyone part of it, like, you know, all that happened, against some resistance, because if it had have come in, it came in when I was ordained just before the council, so I'm young in the priesthood and found it all exciting and wonderful and real. Oh, sometimes in my life I felt like, not just me, but others too, I'm sure, you're in a rowing boat and everyone else is rowing out, trying to go upstream all the time and banging you on the head with a oar. I want to go back into it, back up river where it was safe and where the church was strong, as has been revealed quite clearly lately. And when, in the 50s, that's when we were processing and that's when the church was what it should be. So let's go back to it. No, there's some new wine, and it needs new wineskins. Jesus is bringing a new way of looking at God. It's not entirely new, there are little bits of it in the past, but as an overwhelmingly new view of God, the bridegroom, it is new, and it needs new skins, new ways of relating, new ways of organizing. And now the climax. Jesus is liberating us from the Torah. That's a massively big thing to say. Paul says it, but here it is in Mark. The Sabbath, one Sabbath, was the sacred, it had developed particularly in the exile when they had no temple. And how are they going to be identified? Well, the Sabbath was the way they did. Wonderful thing, a lot to learn from them. They used to gather, because they didn't have a temple, but they'd gather in a hall, and that was their synagogue, it just means the place where they're gathering. And the Sabbath was something very sacred. It's still sacred to Orthodox Jews, and it held them together now for 2,000 years since this time. We're so dependent on the public gathering, and how beautiful is that, on a Sunday in the public gathering. When I was a child, we had a little bit of a substitute for this. We had the family rosary. And we had every first Friday, we had first Thursday of the evening, we had a holy hour in the home. And now there were good things to do. But we haven't ever, seems to me, we haven't yet got a way of prayer that is domestic and doesn't need a priest or a chapel or a church or anything. But it's a thing that we all do, and it's beautiful. And it identifies us. Anyhow, back to the Jews, because they did have something that identified them, namely the Sabbath. Well, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields. And as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. Harmless enough, you'd think. The Pharisees, ready to watch him pick on him, they said, "Look, why are they doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus said to them, arguing with them, or not arguing, presenting something that they would respect, namely the biblical stories. Surely they could see from that there's something other than just sticking with all the little ins and outs of their law. He said to them, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry?" That's all, they were hungry. They were in need of food. "And he entered the house of God, which Abiathar, when he was high priest, and ate the bread of presence," that bread, symbolic bread, "which was not lawful for any but the priest to eat. And he," David, "gave some to his companions." There's a mistake in Mark, because it was the high priest was not Abiathar, it was Abimelech, who is the father of Abiathar. Scholars suggest that probably it was the Abiathar, the father of Abiathar, and the Ab has just dropped away because it's repeated by somebody who didn't know their history. So here's Jesus challenging them from their own writings that there's something more important here than the little legal bits that hang around this very important celebration. He said to them, how important is this? The Sabbath was made for human beings. It's there to help us. It's there to help us keep sacred. It's there to remind us. It's made for us. We're not made for it. The Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Just a little bit, I'll go through this quickly on the Sabbath. The Sabbath became more and more important for Jewish self-identity. Special Sabbath temple sacrifices were instituted. And more importantly, this was the day when the people assembled for prayer in the synagogues. The Sabbath was a day consecrated to God, and its observance was symbolic of the commitment of the people to keep their part of the covenant. How beautiful is that? Book of Exodus, you shall keep my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, given in order that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you, make you holy. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be cut off from among the people. Therefore, the Israelites shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. I hope I don't need to remind you, those words were written by whoever wrote them. They weren't written by God. So their writing, inspired as they are, as best they can in the limits of their culture and view of the world. Isaiah, if you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your own interests on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the holy day of the Lord honourable, if you honour it, not going your own ways, serving your own interests or pursuing your own affairs, you shall take delight in the Lord. Same chapter I read about fasting earlier. Ignatius of Antioch, the very early years of the second century, has this to say. Former adherents of the ancient customs, Jewish people, have since obtained a new hope. A new hope. So they've given up keeping the Sabbath. Now order their lives by the Lord's Day, Dies Domenica, Sunday. Changed. The Sabbath is no longer relevant. They found a new way of covenant, a new covenant. And the covenant they have is this gathering at the Eucharist on the first day of the week, the day of the resurrection. They order their lives by the Lord's Day instead, the day when life first dawned for us, thanks to Jesus and his death. That death is the mystery that has moved us to become believers and endure tribulation to show that we're disciples of Jesus Christ. The problem was, of course, when we lost the feel of it all, the whole Bible was treated as equally inspired by God and equally true, and so the Old Testament images and sacrifices and viewpoint came in and infected the New Testament. So that we, for example, when I was a child, we weren't supposed to work on Sundays. Why not? That comes from the Sabbath. The Sunday's not a Sabbath. Don't neglect, says the letter to the Hebrews, to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encourage one another. To meet at the Christian assembly on the first day of the week. That's a beautiful way to put it, an invitation. Don't neglect to meet together. As time went on, it became a mortal sin not to. So we're again in a Palmer situation. Ignatius again, let no one be under any illusions. A person who excludes himself from the sanctuary is depriving himself of the bread of God. So we must invite everybody as best we can to come to that. If the prayer of one or two individuals has such efficacy, how much more powerful is that of the bishop together with the whole church at the assembly, the synagogue, the Christian synagogue on the Sunday of the resurrection? And the concluding scene. Again, Jesus entered the synagogue. A man was there who had a withered hand. We don't get enough description to know what the disease was, but that'll do us. He shouldn't have been there because any physical defect excluded you. But now he is there. And they, the famous they, are watching Jesus to see whether he'd cure him on the Sabbath so that they could accuse him. Exodus, you shall keep the Sabbath, it's holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it will be cut off from among the people. Rigid tribal law, appropriate probably in a rigid tribe, but not in the gospel of Jesus. Jesus says to the man who had a withered hand, this is beautiful really, come forward. He says to them, in my translation, it jumps between past said and present says, because that's what Mark does, I'm trying to be faithful. When you've moved into the present, it's much more dramatic. You're present at the situation. It's happening while you're there. So he says to the man, come forward. And he says to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save life or to kill? They were silent. He's asking a question that doesn't compute. They're fixed on what the law says. He looked around them with anger. It might be the second time the word anger has been used here of Jesus. The first time could have been with the leper. Explained that to you, but here it is very deliberate. He looks around them angrily. He was grieved at their porosis, I'll put the Greek there for you because you know the word porosis, that's what the word is here, at their hardness of heart. We're all eminently capable of that. And he says to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out and his hand was restored. And here we have everything starting to come together in this opposition. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against Jesus how to destroy him. Looking back over this first part of the first book in Mark. I've just outlined for you what he's saying about Jesus. This is the interpretative commentary that the Biblical Commission talked about, as I mentioned with you earlier. He's presenting Jesus, I'll just run through the list, I don't need to delay, as a liberator, a Messiah, Son of God, Holy One of God, Son of Man, the Physician, the Bridegroom, the one who transcends the Torah, fulfills it, brings everything beautiful into its flowering and leaves the imperfection of it behind. Run through the scenes and then I'll play a hymn for you. We saw a mentally disturbed man in the synagogue. We saw Simon's mother-in-law raised, the word for resurrection, raised for ministry, to serve. An instrument of God's liberating power. We saw a leper embraced. We saw a man paralyzed by sin, freed by love, of course. We saw Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors. We saw him liberating us from the slavish conformity to ritual. Nothing wrong with the ritual. It's the slavish conformity to it that is. We saw him liberating from the narrow interpretation of the law. And finally, a man with a withered hand in the synagogue is healed. And the opposition who accused him of blasphemy, etc., etc., now are determined to destroy.